He had several meetings. This has been a whirlwind trip for him. I'm actually sitting down with him in just a little bit myself to talk about his time here. One of the reasons he was here was the Chamber of Commerce from Salt Lake was in town to lobby for transportation funding. Just to get your listeners caught up here, there's this revolving fund that gas tax pays for that helps replace aging infrastructure. But as gas prices went higher, people started driving less. People were buying more fuel-efficient cars. So it was kind of a lessening tax in some ways because it wasn't bringing in the funds they need. So what Congress is looking at now is some kind of stopgap measure, refill the fund, put in some more money from somewhere else, some other pot. The problem becomes it's an election year and not easy to spend more money. And so they want to offset that with cuts elsewhere. And then you get into fights of where you're going to cut. And Utah leaders are back here saying, we understand this is complicated, but there's aging infrastructure everywhere, and we need money to keep these projects going. UDOT has signed contracts for contractors to go in and actually, start building these roads. And if money dries up, that adds to the cost of the road projects. It delays the road projects and gets you into situations where, they really need to replace some area for safety reasons, but don't have any money. One of the reasons he was here was to help lobby the delegation on that issue. And he's also, I believe, right now, actually, as we speak, sitting down with the HHS Secretary, Health and Human Services Secretary Burwell, because he wants to talk to her about his plan for an alternative Medicaid expansion that would go through the private sector.
Right.
Of course, Herbert's plan needs a waiver from the federal government because it's not what the federal government has planned to do. It's not what's in law. So he needs the secretary to say, okay, this still achieves the goals we want, so therefore you can do it. This is his first meeting with her as secretary. He had good indications from the last secretary, from Sebelius, that the government was on board with the idea. But this is not necessarily he's going to get an answer today, but he might at least be able to persuade her and keep the ball rolling in his favor.
So, did he have an actual agreement with Kathleen Sebelius in the past, or was it kind of a tacit, yeah, we think we can do this, and now he's hoping to carry that momentum forward to an actual agreement?
Yeah, exactly. There's no actual written agreement yet, and the federal government takes a while when they make these kind of waiver decisions. But what he got from Sebelius before, of course, she was on her way out, but what he got from her is that she didn't believe there was anything in the details that would stop them from granting the waiver. That's still a long ways from yes, go ahead, but it wasn't, that there's any big, problematic, controversial issues that was going to stop it. I don't know how Burwell is going to feel about that. Sylvia Burwell is new, and I'm sure she's got a lot of the same staff who've looked at this already. And again, we don't expect any kind of answer today. What we expect is, he can educate the secretary about what Utah plans to do, what he wants to do with the expansion through the private sector, and see if she's on board in any way.
One thing I wonder about Thomas is whether it hurts his cause that he doesn't seem to have yet legislative support for his block grant of Medicaid expansion plan here in Utah.
Yeah, I'm sure he would love to walk into the office and say, this is what the state wants to do, and I've got full backing from the legislature. He obviously doesn't have that. But what he's obviously hoping for too is to be able to walk in there and say, if you give me this, and this has been a fight. I'm fighting my own party on this in the state legislature. If you give me this, it gives me a stronger ability to go back to them and force the issue more with this waiver in hand. And then we achieve the goals the Obama administration wants to do by expanding Medicaid to, those who need it. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything. So what Herbert's saying is he's actually in a position to say, you need to help me help you.
So no answers yet, but we'll see. At least he's beginning negotiations with her.
Yes, exactly.
So, in other news, actually big news out of Washington this week, Thomas, is that House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost to a Tea Partier. Does that have any implications for Utahns in Congress?
Nothing specifically regarding races. Utah doesn't have any primaries where there's any kind of wave that's going to continue on like this. Republicans are nominated and will be going on to November. This isn't something where now members of Congress or incumbents have to worry about in their own reelection, at least as far as challenges from the right. But it does have an impact on Representative Jason Chaffetz. Chaffetz has made no secret that he wants to be chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. This is a very powerful committee in the House. It's the one that, you know, holds all the administration, their feet to the fire on issues from spending in Afghanistan to the IRS scandal to Fast and Furious, gun running. They're the ones who have all these big hearings. And the chairman of that committee has unilateral subpoena power, can just say, hey, I want to have all of your records and sign his name and get it. So Chaffetz really wants that. And he's always had Cantor in his corner. Chaffetz is a big Cantor guy and Cantor is a big Chaffetz guy. So his loss and now his resignation as majority leader kind of hurts Chaffetz in some ways that he'd made these entrees, assuming that Cantor would be in a position to help him. But the good thing for Chaffetz still is that Kevin McCarthy looks like will be without any kind of he actually beat back any challenges, will be the next majority leader. Mm-hmm. And McCarthy and Chaffetz are still close. I actually recall Chaffetz introducing me to McCarthy several years back. So he does still have an ally that could fight for him. You know, it's one of those interesting things that Senator Orrin Hatch also showed, that when you see a challenge from the right like this, the way to combat it. Eric Cantor did not. He kind of took his race with a grain of salt. He didn't really have to worry about it. He spent millions in advertising, but he didn't do the town halls and the meet and greet and stop in every house in the district and say hi to people. Whereas his opponent really did. His opponent really galvanized the conservative movement and grassroots movement. And without any help from big outside groups, I think he only spent $200,000 in his entire campaign to win. Whereas Eric Cantor spent like $160,000 just at steakhouses.
Just at steakhouses. And so Tea Party, I guess the Tea Party guy was David Brat. I guess he better organized in terms of a campaign. This is traditional campaign running. He did it better than Cantor did. Cantor took it for granted.
Yeah, exactly. It just goes back to show, we look at Bob Bennett from 2010, and Bob Bennett obviously lost in convention. And Bennett maybe didn't see or wasn't able to combat quickly enough the tidal wave of Tea Party movement in the country to keep his seat. But, Hatch had a couple years of seeing that, worked it incredibly hard, hired some of the best campaign people in the state, spent the money right, won the convention stuff, and went on to a primary, but won the primary and is now, in his seventh term. That means a lot for somebody who can see the problems out there and combat them. Eric Cantor never did. We can also use the example of Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, who won against, I think, five or six challengers, all from the right flank, and was able to win his seat, even though some people were calling him a Republican in name only or a squish. So in those ways, seeing it and working it is a way to combat the other side.
Thomas, I know your time is limited and you have to go meet Governor Herbert pretty soon, but does this mean, this win by Brat and the defeat of Cantor, does this mean that the Tea Party is still going strong in the United States?
In some corners, yes. It's very clear that in some areas, the Tea Party still holds a lot of sway. And you can call them Tea Party conservatives, the real conservatives, whatever you want to call this kind of movement that's still out there. It may not be organized, but there are places where people are still listening and want the message of anti-Washington, anti-spending, anti-immigration reform, where those voters are really interested and pick up on, and that candidates who are talking about that. It really is a warning to unsuspecting incumbents that they better beware. But it also shows that, as I talked to Senator Bennett this week, that the idea is if you can run a really well-organized, a well-messaged campaign, you still can overcome challenges from the right.
All right. Thomas, last question. Which is having a greater draw on productivity in Washington, D.C., the World Cup or the NBA Finals?
I don't know if you heard just a second ago, my office in the National Press Building is right next to a bureau for Mexican Newswire, and they were cheering on the Mexican team right now. So if your listeners heard that, there's some very excited fans in the office next door. all politics is a sport, and at least we have a real sport to watch on the other side now.
Fantastic. Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks again for taking the time today.
Thank you, Roger.